Greetings, listeners. Hope you had a good week, month, year, however long we've been away for. It seems like it's been quite a while, but you are listening to the After the Anthems podcast, the self-described one-stop shop for all things Canadian soccer. Since we last talked, a lot of things have happened in the Canadian soccer landscape, so we'll break them down for you today. But as always, first, I'm joined by Michael Norton of LastWordOnSports.com. Michael Norton, address the people.
So I was just waking up. Got up from my hibernation. It has been a while. I'm doing all right, though. How you doing, Mitch?
I'm doing all right as well. Also tired, clearly. But yeah, I'm ready to talk about some Canadian soccer. Hopefully that'll wake me up as we go here. Ahead on the show, we'll talk Toronto FC's crease cleanout. Is crease a soccer term? I don't know if that's the best.
I'd say penalty area. Well, not even penalty. What do you call it? The six.
The box, yeah. The box. Six.
The six. The 6 yard box. Yeah. There we go.
I wish I had made some puns with that. I could have gotten some Drake clickbait there. and then also we'll talk about what's ahead for the Whitecaps and the impact after both of them were eliminated from the playoffs. I know, spoiler, if you listened to last edition of the podcast and then went under a rock for a while, we'd never got to talking about both those teams being eliminated. Last we talked, actually, we were pretty optimistic about both their positions, but we'll get into that as well. And then finally, of course, we'll talk a wild month for Canadian soccer. A lot of topics on that front. But first, for once, there's a Canadian, well, a player for a Canadian team. I mean, it's going to be a while. Or I guess De Rosario a bit ago, but a player on a Canadian team who won the MLS award today, Sebastian Giovinco. And I don't think there was any surprise there.
None whatsoever. I mean, you sort of got a bit of a tease with that a few days before when Sebastian Giovinco won the MLS Newcomer of the Year award. And you really saw it coming. You knew going into it that it was Giovinco and Kai Kamara from Columbus and Benny Failhaber from Sporting Kansas City. But this really was Giovinco's award to lose. Statistically, he outplayed both Kamara and Failhaber. And again, going into it, the general consensus was very, very clearly Giovinco.
Yeah, and I think the biggest threat to him would have been Didier Drogba, but obviously Drogba didn't play enough games to be considered a most valuable player, even if he was incredibly valuable to the Montreal Impact and everything they were able to build this year. But I think it was always Giovinco, and I'm not at all surprised that, you know, he wrapped up the three biggest awards, I guess, for an offensive player in Major League Soccer with the Golden Boot, the Newcomer of the Year award, and finally the MLS award. The MLS MVP award. Those are three pretty massive awards and very warranted considering the season he had.
Oh yeah, the records that he's set is unbelievable. And again, beating out Wondolowski's 2012 season, even having the most points combined, that's incredible. Like, you look at somebody, even like Robbie Keane, who for the past bunch of years has been absolutely dominant, and somebody who you could very easily argue has been the best DP in Major League Soccer history. Giovinco had that type of season. He had 22-16, which again is unheard of. Like, Keane has been consistently putting in about 15, 20 goals, 10, 15 assists, but Giovinco took that to a whole nother level, and that is really incredible.
I've probably talked about this before, but what surprised me the most was not the assists. I knew Giovinco was a good playmaker, and I know they marketed him as the number 10, but it was how prolific he was at scoring goals. And he scored them from everywhere. He scored them from free kicks. He scored a couple penalties, which, of course, everyone in Columbus is throwing up as the red flag. Oh, Kamara didn't score any penalties. Well, he scored a lot of penalty-like goals where Ethan Finley put the ball right on a tee for him from, like, 3 feet out. That was a lot of Kai Kamara's goals, but we won't get too far down that rabbit hole. But yeah, he scored from everywhere. He scored all kinds of spectacular goals. He scored the biggest goal in Toronto FC history, probably, which put them in the playoffs finally at last. I've had that, you know, that Luke Wildman voice dinging in my head for a while now, ever since that video came out with Toronto FC at last have made the playoffs. But I don't think there's any surprise here. What was surprising, just to transition, was how Toronto FC started their offseason. I don't necessarily think it's the wrong move, but we'll get into it as well. But they got rid of both of their goaltenders, Chris Konopka and Joe Bendick, as well as Manny Aparicio. Jackson and Robbie Finley is also out of contract. The way that they phrased that was interesting on the Toronto FC website, but we'll get into that as well. I think we start with the goaltenders. pretty surprised, honestly. I didn't think they would get rid of both. Joe Bendik is maybe the obvious choice there, though, because of how much he makes.
Yeah, I can't remember his exact salary number, but I mean, when you've got that sort of situation with two goaltenders, you even look something like hockey, where there's this sort of traditional view that, oh, you can't win with two goaltenders, you have to have your go-to person. And yeah, Konopka had definitely won that battle by the end of the year, but again, he's a guy who doesn't really have that much experience, who was only starting to get it now. And I think for the ambitions that Toronto FC have, they need somebody to step in and really assert themselves as a go-to goaltender, somebody who can make the amount of money that Bendik's making, somebody, if they really need to, that's making more than what Bendik was making, and just take that team and be that rock that they have not had, frankly, since Stephen Fry.
Mm. Yeah, and I think it's a vote of confidence as well for the young goaltenders. I don't see them bringing in more than one goalkeeper. I think they'll bring in a number one, be that, you know, a Tally Hall, a Dan Kennedy, or if you're Toronto FC, you're probably going to bring some semi-washed up older professional keeper from Europe who will be a bigger name. I think we could see another Julio Cesar, or Julio rather, Portuguese pronunciation. And I wouldn't be against that. I mean, I think he might have been the best goaltender Toronto FC's ever had in his short period of time. Mm. That's debatable. But yeah, I really do think that this is a good sign that, you know, Toronto FC's confident in their young goaltenders. I know last year at the draft, everyone was surprised they picked up Alex Bono because it was like, when's he going to play? Joe Bendik's got the number one locked up. Chris Konopka's, you know, a pretty decent backup. And Quillen Roberts is a good young goaltender. Well, psych, two of the three are now gone. And I think Bono, honestly, has fallen behind Quillen Roberts maybe in the depth chart. But I think either of them has a good chance of being the backup next season. And the one who isn't will obviously be the full-time starter for Toronto FC too. So it's a good position for both these young goaltenders to be in. And yeah, it should be interesting to see. Do you think, you know, looking at potentially Tally Hall, Dan Kennedy, which option would you look at as maybe the good one?
I think both are good options, but I think at this point Toronto FC really do have to go with just one option. They took out two. By getting rid of two of their goalkeepers, again, like you said, they've really paved the way.
Yeah.
I don't think that whoever goalkeeper, I think that the general consensus is that Quillen Roberts has, again, like you said, overtaken Alex Bono in the depth chart. Whichever one it happens to be is who is the backup, they will not get much time, or at least they shouldn't, because Toronto FC still needs to get that shutdown goalkeeper, again, like a Tally Hall, like a Dan yeah. Kennedy. Frankly, if I am Toronto FC, I am going after a Dan Kennedy type. I think that there's been this age-old myth of Dan Kennedy was exceptional on a terrible team in Chivas USA, and there's been this passion to know what he can do on a good team, let alone a competent one. And Toronto FC has had flashes of being a good team. They've got the best player in Major League Soccer, arguably in Major League Soccer history, on their side, and they are starting to build towards that. And I think Kennedy could be a great piece to that. Again, it can be just a matter of price. Like, Dallas could command a decent bit for Kennedy because, again, there is that uncertainty. Yes, he had a bad year this year, but could he bounce back? You never know. And if he is good, we have seen what Dan Kennedy can do when he is good, and he can be very good.
Yeah, and I think you need a competent backline general. I think that's what they should be looking for as well, because I never saw Bendik or Konopka as a goalkeeper. They were good shot stoppers, both of them, obviously. But I didn't see either of them as being very organized with their backline, being very good at possessing the ball, which, you know, is never the top priority when you're looking at a goalkeeper. But in today's game, especially with the way a team like Toronto FC play, you need a goalkeeper who's able to handle the ball and who's able to, you know, get the ball into feet, because the Toronto FC's players, they're not, you know, not too many of them are, you know, real destroyers. Will they go out and steal the ball? I think they have a lot of players who are very good when the ball's at their feet. But, you know, you have to take possession seriously and have to try and keep it. And too many times you saw both Konopka and especially Bendik, you know, he was always criticized for this, just kicking it long and not being able to get it to a player. That's pretty destructive for Toronto FC. So having someone, firstly, who can organize the defensive back line, but can also play a little bit with their feet. And I know in Major League Soccer, this may be difficult. You know, these are a lot of, boxes to check off, but there's a lot of goalkeepers out there, and I think that Toronto FC could find one with the right fit.
I think my prediction right now, I think if you're looking for your leader, someone who can really assert themselves, I would tend towards Dan Kennedy.
Hmm.
So I think the logical definition now for Tally Hall is that you go to the Philadelphia Union, because we all know they're always looking for goalkeepers, right? So, I mean, there's got to be a spot for him.
What we're saying is Iker Casillas will be your Toronto FC goaltender for 2016. at any rate, let's move on to some of the other players dropped. There were two more who... So basically what the press release said, and it was a little interesting, was that they picked up the options on Manny Aparicio and Jackson, and that Robbie Finley was out of contract. A lot of people took this to mean they're going to maybe try and re-sign Robbie Finley and to like a lesser term. But by the sounds of things, John Molinaro said that, you know, maybe Bill Manning isn't really the biggest Robbie Finley fan and we might not see him back. I wouldn't necessarily be against that. You know, I like what Robbie Finley brought in some ways, but he was just way too expensive at 200 plus thousand. That's a lot of money for a player who, you know, spent a lot of the season sitting on the bench. And also when he was on the field, he never really quite fit the Toronto FC system. He was kind of a number nine who they tried to play out on the wing, I feel like. And you're not starting over Josie Altidore, and even Luke Moore is a better number nine, in my opinion, and Hercules Gomez. So it was just difficult, and they were pretty convoluted at that position. So moving him out, Jackson is a player who could do a lot of things for Toronto FC, but I never really saw him doing anything particularly well. How did you see these?
I think you're fair in that, in your points. I think that a lot of what defines Toronto FC's front line is there's a lot of players, and a lot of them are making a decent sum of money to a, what you could very reasonably argue is too decent. Even if you
too
go
decent.
Yeah, Josie Altidore, like, for example, he's making a truckload of money, and we know that. But even, again, going to the bench, Hercules Gomez is making a lot.
Yeah.
Robbie Finley is definitely making a lot. And
Luke Moore, frankly, is making a fair amount, too.
Yeah, and, like, none of them have really asserted themselves as this is the person that we bring on 60 minutes into a match if we need a goal. None of them did that. It seemed very much like a carousel, and I think that Toronto FC, they need to find that person who does that. Whether it is an internal option like Hercules Gomez, like a proven pest, proven killer, but I don't know. He's starting to get older now, and does he really have it left in him? Who knows? I think that they need to find that option, though, because they don't have that depth of scoring off the bench. They are very reliant on Giovinco and even Altidore at the start of the season, and I think having that option will be good. Is it an internal option? Again, even you look younger, guys like Jordan Hamilton. I don't know. The thing with them is that they're not really getting the chances now that TFC is spending this money, because, again, you look at it, you put somebody like a Finley or a Gomez on a bench, and people are going to be crying out, you're paying this guy $200,000, $300,000 to do this. So I don't know where to go, really.
The whole academy thing might be a topic for a different day, but one thing that I'm thinking, and this may eventually turn into an article, I think it will, on Waking the Red, is, you know, how much Toronto FC has been paying for the offensive players versus how much they're paying for their defensive players. I mean, you have their top, you know, options are obviously all, other than Bradley's a bit of mixed in terms of what position he plays, but their top two players in terms of salary are offensive players, and then everyone on the bench is making, you know, over 1,000 or over 100,000 rather per year. I would hope they're making over 1,000. You know,
that would not be legal.
I don't think that'd be low
even for Major League Soccer.
Yeah. I don't know. Mark Bloom made close to that one season, I think.
That's true.
But yeah, no, they just haven't been spending the money on their back line, and you know, shedding some of that money that they're paying for forwards who, like Norton said, aren't really game breakers. I think in moving that to defensive options will help balance out this team going forward. Now, the last player finally who was dropped was Manny Aparicio. I think that's a simple explanation, so I'll just handle that one myself. He wasn't going to make this team within the next couple of years. I think that Chris Minella is ahead of him on the TFC Academy, I guess, depth chart. I think that there's a couple of other younger guys coming up who are ahead of him as well. So while Manny Aparicio is a good player, and I do expect him to catch on somewhere, whether that be CIS or NASL, I think he could be a good fit for the Ottawa Fury if they want to, you know, if they want to have a bit of a project there. I would love to see him in Ottawa. But yeah, he just wasn't going to play for Toronto FC in the next couple of years, and they kind of, I don't want to say cut the fat because that always sounds bad, but yeah, they kind of had to let someone go from that academy setup, and yeah, it just made sense that it was Manny Aparicio. Now, who they kept was interesting as well. In goal, they kept Quillen Roberts, obviously, had a very good season with Toronto FC too. I think we've talked quickly about Quillen Roberts, so we'll just move on to the back line. Ashton Morgan, Josh Williams, Nick Haglund, and Eric Zavaleta all kept. Interesting to see them stay the course with the back line.
Yeah, it's kind of similar, the back line and the front line. It's the recurring theme of they've got a lot of faces,
yeah,
and no one is stepping up. Now, it's nicer with the back line because you do have much more inexpensive options, save for Damian Perkis, Ahmed Kantari. The others, they're not making as much.
Yeah.
But it would still be nice to see somebody step up. And frankly, I don't know if this is the right move to keep all of them there. I don't know. They don't have many places on the roster to work with. And unless they can find somebody who's looking to take these players on in a trade, they don't have a lot of room left on their roster to fill. And I don't know how much space. Like, I think they would benefit from having more space to work with. Because we know they have the money, yeah, and they have spent it before, and they will. But I feel like this move sort of limits themselves like that.
I mean, it could be trade bait, but at the same time, I like the I like the fact that they're building depth. I mean, this is something that Toronto FC's never had, is backline depth. And I mean, you look at the left back position. You've got Justin Morrow, who's the obvious starter and will be the obvious starter for several years now. But, you know, should he go down to injury, you've got, which, you know, God forbid, but it happens a lot in Toronto. You've got Ashton Morgan there waiting in the wings to fill in. And then at the same time, you know, Josh Williams can play right back. He can, and he can play in the middle as well. So you've got a flexible player there. Eric Zavaleta, I really liked. I think he's got a lot of quality about him, and he's still young. He can be turned. And Nick Haglund, I mean, he could be a good trade piece because he does have that, you know, that cachet still around him, where he was at least in the conversation for a little bit for MLS Rookie of the Year in his rookie season. Kind of fell off, but he, you know, he's a good personality to have around the club, honestly.
As long as you don't play him against Fabian Castillo, yeah, you'll be
that
okay.
That was ridiculous. Oh my.
Keep him in the middle. Don't put him out on the wing. He doesn't have the pace for it, unfortunately.
How bizarre was that night, just as a quick aside, eh?
My goodness.
Castillo burns him, and then that was also sort of the birth of Giovinco scoring two goals, so... You know, that night, and that rainy night in Dallas might be one to remember for a while. But yeah, I just, you know, I think that provided they make a couple moves here where they shore up their back line and shore up some of the starting positions, I think honestly they need a new starting center back, and then you see what you have with, you know, a Mark Bloom and Josh Williams and let them compete for that. But last season, an injury to Mark Bloom basically derailed their back line for the entire season. They had no idea what they were doing at right back, and it cost them all the way up to the playoffs. That's not good. That's not a good indicament on either management or coaching, but it was also the truth of who they had in their lineup. This year, I don't see that happening if they have all these pieces in place.
I think you're fair. I think, yeah, absolutely, the Bloom injury derailed a lot of things, and you saw players like Marky Delgado, players like Jackson moving into that position that they really weren't that suited for, especially Jackson, somebody who didn't really have the defensive tendencies to handle a fullback position.
Yeah.
And I think that people playing out of position, again, somebody like Haglund, somebody... Williams, I think, would be better suited to play out of position. But yeah, like having Bloom back, I think, will absolutely be huge. I think having the left back depth in Morrow and in Morgan is great, but again, you just have to look at the center, and you need one of those players to really step up. Williams showed signs of it. I think that he could be. I think at this point, he is the most likely candidate to step up and be potentially a number two, but at this point, we definitely need a number one because we don't really know if Perkis is. He maybe, but I don't think it's likely, and Kantari, we don't think it's likely, and frankly, he is being paid a whole lot of money, and he should be for that sort of salary. And if you're looking at a number one, it's tough to go out and get one, but again, you look at Montreal and Vancouver, and they both went outside of Major League Soccer,
yeah,
and they got each one got a finalist for the league's Defender of the Year, and you saw the impact that those two guys had. Kendall Waston and Tim Parker have formed a brilliant partnership in Vancouver, and Laurent Simon, I think it's like 14 goals fewer than the impact conceded this year, and so much of that has to go to Simon. So you see the impact of having somebody who can just take over a back line, and we were saying it before with Dan Kennedy, but having that even farther up, having a defender that can do that as well is so vital, and Toronto FC need to find that.
Yeah, I'd fully agree. Now let's brush over the rest of the players who they gave contracts to or picked up the options, rather, as we've spent a lot of time talking Toronto FC, so might be time to move on a little bit. In the midfield, Colin Warner, Dan Lovitz, Marky Delgado, and Chris Minella. I think all of those are smart moves. They're all good depth players who, you know, are making decent amounts of money and will be back next season and give them options. And then up front, Jordan Hamilton. Yeah, I don't see any problems with any of those five players.
I don't think so. I think that it's just a matter of getting these guys their chances. I mean, guys like Dan Lovitz and Jordan Hamilton, these young kids, like, you wonder, because TFC is getting this bought, not built team mentality, I think that you're seeing a lot of success in teams that have invested in their homegrown talent, in their young players, teams like Columbus and like Dallas. And you got to wonder, TFC isn't really doing a lot of that, but I think they should. And I think keeping these guys around is a start, but let's see them on the field a little bit more.
I think they should as well, and I'd really like to see a Chris Minella get some minutes next year, because I do think he's a player who, you know, seeing him at the Pan Am Games, seeing him at an Olympic qualifying, he's a player who really does have a lot of talent and really can, you know, be the next maybe Michael Bradley for Toronto FC. I don't know if he'll ever be that good, but he's got a lot of quality to him, and he kind of mimics himself as a midfield tenor. I mean, he's the captain of Toronto FC too, so I'd love to see him get minutes. And then Jordan Hamilton seems like the type of player, from everything I've seen, where, you know, he gets on the field and he scores. Like, it doesn't matter what the level is. He's just one of those players who had a nose for goal at every level, and he didn't have a great year for Toronto FC too this year, but, you know, I wonder if you just give him that shot at the next level, if he'll step up more. He's almost, you know, for a while there, he was ahead of Kyle Larratt on the Canadian depth chart. And so, and you know, I know he feels like, from conversations I've had, he kind of feels like if he got that shot, you know, he could be Kyle Larratt. And, you know, that's pretty exciting for a Toronto FC fan to hear, because, you know, if they could have the next Kyle Larratt, that would be pretty massive for this club, even coming off the bench a player like that. And no, I don't think Jordan Hamilton would be a Kyle Larratt right away, but I think he has a lot of the same qualities where if they did give him a chance, you know, he could definitely show some stuff. So, yeah, I do hope they give more academy players a chance next year. Now let's move on from Toronto FC. We have spent a lot of time talking about them. Let's move on to the Vancouver Whitecaps. A bit of a different season ending for the Vancouver Whitecaps. They did get a bye through the knockout stage of the playoffs and then got to the next round, where they lost 2-0 to the Portland Timbers. I know during the last podcast we talked about how they were in a good position after going 0-0 on the road to Portland, but that good position didn't end up coming to fruition.
Yeah, something just rhymes. Fell through. Something just fell through. It's unfortunate. I think that they've got a lot of pieces, but again, it's just a lack of finishing. It's almost like they're a Canadian national team. it's phenomenal. Defensively, again, like I said before, they're brilliant. Kendall Waston, Tim Parker, David Oustad was brilliant this year too. Like, they've got those building blocks. It's just they got to find the icing on the cake and somebody who can score like Octavio Rivero did for the first few weeks of the season, but doing that on a more consistent basis.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I was looking at all the players they brought back, and they brought back a lot of offensive players, but it was still, and we'll talk about that in a second, but it was still like, who's their main guy up front? They have a lot of guys who can do a lot of good things offensively, but they don't have a lot of guys who can put up, you know, 10-plus goals. You know, Maddox, Mané, Hurtado, they all seem to kind of max out. They'll score a couple goals for you and then they'll disappear. They need a consistent striker up top.
Every single one of those guys you've seen in flashes. There was a time, I think it was last season where Eric Hurtado was absolutely unbelievable. He scored a screamer against Seattle. Mm. Darren Maddox, I have liked for a long time. I still remember in 2012. I think still on MLSsoccer.com, a little aside here.
Yeah.
I think my icon, my avatar for that is still Darren Maddox jumping over Logan Emery and Milos Kosic to get that header from that incredible game. So, like, he had flashes back a few years ago. And Kakuta Mane, everyone seem to be talking about him for the last two or three seasons. It's when is he going to break out? When is he going to do this? We know that these guys are freak of nature athletes with pace to burn and are strong. And that those are amazing qualities. It's just you compare that to somebody like, I don't know, say a Didier Drogba, who again is a freak of nature athlete, incredibly strong, doesn't have the pace anymore, but he used to be quick enough and just had the vision and all these intangibles. But when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, it's putting the ball in the back of the net. And these guys have done it in flashes, but we need those flashes to be more sustained.
That's how I see it as well. You know, they're incredible athletes, all three of them, but they don't have the finishing. And I think Rivero is a player who will end up being special for them. I think that, you know, he maybe needed a year to adjust and he'll be good for them. But I think they do need another option there. If they're going to play with more than one attacking player up front, they could go five in the midfield because, as we'll talk in a bit,
they have a lot of midfields.
Yeah. But, you know, yeah, I think that the forward is one of the positions that they'll have to look at next season.
It could be an issue of roster space, too. Again, like I was saying with Toronto FC, they've just got a glut of players and signing all these guys. Like, how much space do you have? Because, now, yeah, you've got Rivero, Hurtado, Mane, Maddox. That's a lot of forwards. And, like, is it worth keeping all of them, really? Like, that question has to come up. You've got, again, in Mane, Maddox, and Hurtado, you've got three. It's, I don't want to say they're identical because they're not, but it's tough not to group them all into that same sort of category. And you got to wonder, do you really need three of those types?
Is it worth getting rid of all of them, though? I think that they could probably use one of these players as a trade bait. I think that there's a lot of Major League Soccer teams out there that would look at a player like Mane, like Maddox, and like Hurtado especially, and maybe, you know, see the qualities that they have and think they could mold them into something more. And potentially they could, but at this point they provide good trading or trade bait, I guess, for the Vancouver Whitecaps. And I think that's why, you know, keeping them for an extra year isn't necessarily the worst case in terms of, you know, asset management in general. Now let's look at the season as a whole from Vancouver. And there was a lot of ups and downs, but in the end, I think it was a step forward, but was it a success? I find that hard to say.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, they had that great start, and it just fell apart against Portland. I mean, I watched that match, but it's been a while, granted, but I just can't remember them really generating a lot of buzz and a lot of anything that looked great. It seemed like Portland just took it to them. And the fact that Vancouver was pressing to try and tie it late, but then Portland just came, stormed back, and scored another one on. Like, it's just, they fell flat, and it's unfortunate. And again, we both agree they've got pieces, especially that midfield. It's not a Columbus-type midfield, but it's a good midfield, and they can work with that. And their back line is great. It's just wrapping everything up and getting it to that next level seems to be their issue.
Yeah, and the evident turning point was the back-to-back losses to the Seattle Sounders at midseason. The 3-0 losses.
Without
both
a doubt.
Yeah, both in Champions League or to eliminate them from the Champions League and in Major League Soccer, which seemed to kick them into a downward spiral. And yeah, after that, they just never looked like the same team. They couldn't score, and that's pretty much where it went. They, you know, they defended pretty well all season. They were, I believe, tied for the best defense in Major League Soccer. And we saw that again in the playoffs. I mean, they only conceded two goals over two games, but they didn't score any goals there either. So I think that offensively, that's completely what you have to look for next season. They have the midfield players to build it to that final point, but they have to get some more finishers. Now let's look quickly at the 10 players they gave offers to and who are moving on. The 10 players they gave offers to were Marco Carducci and David Osted, Sam Adekugbe, Jordan Smith, Tim Parker, Gershon Kofi, Nicholas Mosqueda, and as we already talked about, that front trio of Eric Hurtado, Kakuta Mane, and Darren Maddox. I think all are smart moves. I mean, bringing back Gershon Kofi, you kind of have Russell Tybert. They're pretty similar players, but they're also both, like, they're similar in good ways. I mean, they're both talented players.
Like you said, it's a matter of asset management. If they don't bring back Gershon Kofi, somebody is going to take him in a re-entry draft, and they're literally going to lose him for nothing.
Yeah, David Ostead is the obvious choice. I mean, he, for me, should have been MLS Keeper of the Year. He's had a very good season for them. And then, you know, young defenders like Sam Adekubi and Tim Parker had a great year as well.
Parker came out of almost nowhere. Like, it would seem like, I think it was Christian Dean who they took first. Maybe that even was 2014, that draft. But, yeah, Tim Parker, he just came out and was getting a whole lot of really good praise. And seems like he and Waston have formed a great partnership that, frankly, Waston isn't even 28 years old, I think. They can build that for, like, five seasons. That's brilliant.
Yeah, when you have the best backline in MLS, there's not really anything to change. You just have to keep it and then move forward from there, especially if it's young. I would value a guy like Sam Adekubi, who obviously has been involved in the Canadian setup. I'd value him to get some more time next season, especially if a guy like Steven Bateshaw, which is really interesting. Now let's move on to the guys whose options they declined. Paolo Tornati, their backup goalie. I'm sure I said that wrong. I guarantee. Steven Bateshaw, Pamadou Ka, Ethan Sampson, Andre Lewis, and Caleb Clark. But the obvious one is Bateshaw, who, you know, was their starting right back. And, you know, again, they were the best defense in MLS. You know, you'd think they'd keep him.
Yeah, that one comes as a big shock to me because Bateshaw, for a number of years, he's got a lot of really good praise. Even going back to the Goonies of 2012, he was part of that team with Justin Morrow on the other side, if we want to bring things full circle. But yeah, even Matt Doyle, the MLSsoccer.com's armchair analyst, he released his own version of the best 11, and he's very much a traditional position-by-position sort of guy. So rather than having a team with two defenders and like nine forwards, he does a very strict 4-4-2. And he had Bateshaw as his right back. So yeah, it was not, everyone knows it was not a great year for fullbacks in Major League Soccer. But Bateshaw has been proven to be very, very good at what he does. He is like a Morrow type. And frankly, he earns pretty much the same thing as Justin Morrow. So it is very shocking to me that they did not pick him up.
Now, the rumor is he'll be brought back for less money, and whether or not that's true, we'll find out. But at the same time, yeah, it was very surprising that they didn't pick up the option on him. Another surprise for me, more on a Canadian men's national team side, was Caleb Clark, who is a player who I thought had a pretty good season with Whitecaps too, and every time I saw him play for the national team, he was pretty good as well. So, you know, it's tough to see another, you know, we talked about Manny Aparicio in Toronto FC. It's another academy product who's kind of falling by the wayside. We'll see where Caleb Clark ends up. I know he had a successful run with Augsburg too in Germany. Again, probably said that wrong. but yeah, he did have a successful run in Germany, so we could see him head back there after the season, or next season, as that's a possibility for him there. We already talked about this a little bit. What do Vancouver need to do to take the step forward? I personally think, as I already said, they have to get an offensive player who can score goals for them. But I also do think they need to add someone in the midfield as well, whether that be a holding midfielder to play beside Matias Laba, because I like Matias Laba. I like what he does. He's obviously one of the best at what he does in Major League Soccer, but he kind of needs a player to go forward beside him. And, you know, Will Johnson might be a possibility there, as has been rumored, but I think there's a lot of options there.
You know, looking at an attacking midfielder, you say, I see where you're coming from there. I think that, yeah, you sort of look at that, the balance, I guess. You want to have your defenders, you want to have your defensive midfielder, and then somebody just to link. I don't know. I still think that Pedro Morales can be that link. Like, fine. Do I praise Pedro Morales too much? Probably. He is an absolutely world-class passer. I still think he can be that link if he stays healthy. I still think he's got even, say, two more good years before he starts. He's like a Diego Valeri type. On his day, he can go toe-to-toe with Diego Valeri. And in 2014, he very much did. He was better than Valeri. So I think he can be that link. But, yeah, it just comes down to those. It's great that you've got that set up. Even look at a Kamara type, frankly. Like somebody who, again, had a brilliant setup team behind him. Very good midfield. And it just made his job that much easier. But he could consistently put the ball in the back of the net.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't necessarily mean like an attacking midfielder. I meant more, you know, if you're Vancouver, you probably play five midfielders and you have two holding midfielders, just one who, Laba's a pretty strictly defensive midfielder. You'd have one who could kind of get forward a little bit and make more passes deep and then find, you know, your attacking options. I know they had Russell Tybert and Gershon Kofi playing there a bit this season, but I still see
Tybert. But even both of them are, they're, I don't know, they're more the defensive type, are they not?
Well, no, I see Tybert more as a winger, really. I think you'd move him up and play him on the left-hand side. That's where he started his career. That's where he's always played with Canada national team. And, I mean, every time he comes off the bench, I swear, he takes... You know, he takes over the game and has one or two dipping shots from outside the box that eventually one of those is going to go in. And he's going to be a hero for the Canadian men's national team. But honestly, I've always liked how he's looked as a winger versus as a holding midfielder. So, you know, he's also one of the players who they picked up an option on. So I'd see him definitely as a core player for them going forward and hopefully moving him forward in the setup as well. Now let's move or switch gears quickly to the Montreal Impact, the final team we haven't talked about yet, and technically they got the furthest of any Canadian team because they did make extra time. They had they had that extra period of soccer, but they did end up losing to Kai Kamara and the Columbus Crew as well, but mostly Kai Kamara. Kai,
they got Kamara.
This was a successful season for me. They had the Champions League final, which was, you know, a huge deal to start the season. I never would have seen a team like that getting that far. And of course, they made it again. I see them as making it the furthest among Canadian teams, but I don't know how sustainable it is. I see what they did this season, and I see, you know, I see Drogba coming in and just propping up a team that has a lot of good pieces and has a lot of good things, but isn't necessarily primed to do the same next season.
Well, going off the word prime, there's a lot of outside of their prime type players. You've got Didier Drogba, who is 37 years old. You've got Patrice Bernier, who out of absolutely nowhere had a resurgence towards the end of this season. He's 35 or 36 now. Ignacio Piatti, he's been very good. He's been, again, like a Valeri type for Montreal, and at times he's been a very, very good attacking midfielder. He's on the wrong side of 30. Simon's fine. I think he's 28 or 29 years old. He's fine. But, yeah, you look, especially Drogba and these guys, you wonder how much longer they can go for. And, frankly, I was talking to you before the show, like, how much longer does the Drogba effect stay with this club? The allure of this arguably the best forward the world has seen in the last 10 years, that allure is, it might not ever wear off entirely, but he's come and he's now established. So how much more is there that props that up? I don't know.
It almost seems forgotten because of how incredible this season ended up being for the Montreal Impact, but right when Drogba was starting with the club, they fired their coach. They fired Frank Klopas. And, you know, I think that's just an indication of the fact that this team isn't, you know, like...
It's fragile.
Yeah, if we can use a word. That's a very good word to describe it. They're fragile, and they could, you know, they could go down next season. They could go both ways next season, depending upon who they bring in. But I do think they need to bring in a couple of players here because... at the end of the day, I don't think that, you know, if you put the same roster out next season, I don't think that Drogba is going to be the same world beater. And I mean, Drogba always proves everyone wrong, so he probably will now, but I don't think Drogba is going to be the same world beater. I think Ignacio Piatti might slow down a little bit. I think some of the other options, and, you know, we even look at...
But what are their other options? Like, really, that's the other part of this fragility. Like, I mean, Drogba... He masked a lot of issues that they have.
Oh, absolutely.
They're finishing. They're kind of like Toronto. They have just with fewer options on the bench and guys who still can't hit a barn door for their lives. Dominic Odor. Sorry. But yeah, like he covered a lot of those issues up. And again, you wonder how much longer he can cover that up for. Frankly, I'm still shocked that they traded Jack McInerney to Columbus because. Yes, Jack McInerney has not been the scoring sensation that people thought that he would be in his time in Philadelphia, but he's become pretty much a lost man in Columbus, and I think he would be much better suited in Montreal, where he's backing up somebody who is 6 or 7 years older than Kai Kamara, and he will definitely get that play time, and he's got that experience. And McInerney, he's somebody who I think could even drop down if need be. I think he's a bit more versatile than somebody like a Drogba or a Kamara, who is very strictly a number nine. And we saw when Drogba got put on the wing, it didn't work out very well. He's very clearly a center forward. There's no questions asked about that. But McInerney has that versatility, and I think that could fit in a lot better to a Montreal team. So who else do they have at this point?
It's interesting that we said, you know, God forbid Justin Morrow get injured on the Toronto back line, and how much that would, maybe not necessarily now that they're hopefully building more depth, but how much that would have derailed this past season and everything else. How much would an injury to Didier Drogba derail Montreal's season? Because, you know, you could say the same thing about any star player on any team around the league, but even as a strict number nine, who are their other number nine options? Dominic Oduro is not a number nine. He's a pretty decent winger in this league. You know, we criticize him for everything he can. You know, he fails to do around the 6 yard box.
He did score 11 goals in 2011. We'll give him that much. He's just never hit it again.
Yeah. At the same time, he can beat players. He can be a dangerous attacking player, and he seems to pop up in the best situations possible, as he did for Montreal this season. But who are you playing at number nine? You know, you better be pretty dang confident in Anthony Jackson-Hamel as your, you know, your next option, because you don't have Jack McInerney, you don't have any other real players there. So there are some areas of concern for Montreal, but, you know, they could be addressed this offseason. We'll see. One of those questions that needs to be addressed is whether Mauro Biello should be back as head coach. I mean, he's technically, I think, still in the interim tag. How do you feel about this, Norton?
Well, I think they've given him the vote of confidence. I think that, yeah. I can't remember if the interim tag is on or off, but I think that at this point, they just haven't had enough time. It's too small of a sample size. And really, again, I think a lot of it does have to do with Drogba coming in. Let a little bit of a sense of realism set in for a bit, and let that wave of emotion and incredible play just settle down for a bit. And again, just a little shot of reality, start of the season. We'll see how things go. I think that Montreal needs to give this time. I think that they've made their decision. I think they are going to keep him on, but I think a decision going forward, definitely wait until the summer on this. I think that, I don't know, it's weird because Montreal, I look at it this past year, it was very much a tale of two seasons. They had their Champions League absolutely. Run, and I would even argue they got very lucky because of that Champions League run. That pushed a lot of their league games toward the end. We criticize Major League Soccer's schedule, but Montreal had like five games in hand on everybody until like the last week of the season somehow, and then all of a sudden Drogba comes in, tears up everybody, and all of a sudden they're like third place in the East or something insane. But I think, yeah, you've got to give Biello a bit more time and a bit more of a real situation and let it play out.
That's why Drogba was able to do what he did, was because they had such, you know, much fixture congestion. He was able to just come in and...
Any other team, he would not have had whatever it was, 11 or 12 match, he would have had like 7 or 8 matches, and all of a sudden that changes things entirely.
Yeah, and they could have been spread out over a significant period of time, and maybe he wouldn't have been in such good form, and he missed a couple games for Montreal as well. So what, you know, that, like, those games would have been more significant for another club. But, you know, I digress. I think, you know, if Toronto's keeping Greg Vanney, and not that every club should treat things equally, but if Toronto's giving Greg Vanney another shot, you definitely have to give Mauro Biello another shot, because as you said, Norton, it was a small sample size, but it was a good small sample size. I mean, he got them to the playoffs. He got them a home field advantage in the first round of the playoffs. He, you know, he got them to extra time against the Columbus Crew, who are now in the MLS Cup final. And let's switch gears to that. So both Montreal and Vancouver were eliminated by MLS Cup final.
Moment of silence.
Yeah. Okay, we're back. Yep. Canadian killers, really. And so the Columbus Crew and the Portland Timbers will be meeting in the MLS Cup final this weekend. What are your predictions for this game, Norton?
I gotta like Columbus in this one. I mean, Portland does have a very good road record, but I mean, yes, I harp on things a lot, but Columbus's midfield is just stupidly good. It really is phenomenal, and I think that they've got a really, really good setup. I think that, yes, Kai Kamara is a very good player. He has proven that in his time in Major League Soccer. But he has come into a system in Columbus where it's kind of like Vancouver, but even better. They had a very good setup behind everybody but the forward, and they just needed that last piece. And he has been as good a last piece as they could have asked for. He has been getting the very, very good service. He is consistently regardless of how good or bad his looks have been, he's been putting in the net in more ways than one. He's a great aerial threat. We know what he can do with his finishing skills. And I think that they are just a very well-oiled machine. They've got something that just clicks really well. Their mid-season signings in the back have been good.
Yeah.
I wonder about the center back position. Parkhurst, and I think it's Saro who's with them as well. I wonder sometimes. They're good, but they're not great. But I think that the guys in front of them have enough to cover that up.
This is the way I see it, and it's, I guess it's kind of hypothetical, but if this was a two-legged thing or a two-legged competition, I would see the Portland Timbers taking it. In a one game, it's the Columbus Crew. I think Columbus has the offensive firepower. They just kind of have that one-game mentality where they haven't necessarily been the best team this season. They've had a lot of ups and downs, and they haven't been defensively great and what have you, but when the games have mattered, they've always stepped up, and they've always been very, very good. Especially, you know, you look later in the season when everything was super convoluted and, you know, things mattered. They beat DC United 5-0 on the final game of the season and just ran them over. And then they go out and beat the Montreal Impact in the next round. And also impressive fashion, you know, a very hot Montreal Impact team at that. They silenced them at home. And then they go out and take down arguably the best team in Major League Soccer at that time, which was the New York Red Bulls. So I think Columbus is just hot enough at the right time to get this done. And as you said, their best players are firing on all cylinders. If Kai Kamara playing amazing, and that's where it really starts and ends for a team like that. Mm-hmm. If you have your big scorer playing incredibly well, then all you have to do really is just hold on and just make sure that you take care of business at your own end, because you know you're going to be getting one or two goals.
You know what this reminds me of in a way? It's almost like MLS Cup 2012 or 2013 when 2012 you had San Jose steamrolling everybody off the heels of Wondolowski and the Goonies, but they were eliminated, and it was Los Angeles and Houston. And even in 2013 you had a team like RSL, the mighty dynasty that they were, of always finishing in second place. Portland and Columbus are two teams. You could argue that at times they were great at points during the season. Obviously the last game of the season, Columbus were absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And I think that Columbus, more so than Portland, has the potential to be a fantastic team. But I don't think consistently either of them were. But the thing that you see from them is that they can play with anybody. And you've seen that a lot from Portland recently, going up against Sporting Kansas City, going up against Vancouver, and then Dallas. Holy, I really thought Dallas was going to destroy them there. But without Diego Valeri, Portland, even still in that first leg, was great, and they took it to Dallas in the second leg. But yeah, these are teams that can play with anybody. They have enough confidence, and they don't doubt their abilities, whether they are as talented as a team like New York or like Dallas. So I think that in that way, these teams are pretty similar, but I think that Columbus does have the edge in just overall quality.
I'm pretty stunned that Portland made the final, honestly. Agreed. I'm looking at their entire season, you know, I thought they were going to miss the playoffs, honestly, for most of it. And then they come out and play well down the stretch and take out Vancouver and then, you know, just go from there. And, yeah, both of these teams are – I mean, every team that makes the MLS Cup final is riding a hot wave. But these teams – you know, you could have seen Columbus, because the East was pretty, you know, beyond New York. It was pretty gnarly. There was a ton of teams who were just so close, by the closest of margins, the entire year. But the West, I really thought that, you know, someone like LA or Seattle or even FC Dallas would run away with it. I never would have thought Portland would get through, but
yeah, it's weird. Like Portland, you even looked back as recently as last year when you had a team like the New England Revolution, and it was very clear for them the turning point was Jermaine Jones. They bring him in. Yes, he's not getting the statistics that Didier Drogba is getting this year, but a very similar effect. He is taking a team that has that potential and just absolutely elevating to unbelievable levels. And New England was riding an incredible hot streak, and they came up short in the end. Portland, it's weird because their hot streak isn't anywhere near as long. Like, I don't think they closed out the season in particularly spectacular fashion. It's just been these playoffs. And yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, now let's talk about the only The only Canadian angle, I guess, here on this MLS Cup final. And as per usual, it's pretty negative. Will Johnson has been pretty much cut out of the Portland Timbers down the stretch. He's barely featured in these playoffs at all. If he has, and I can't fully remember, but it's been like minor minutes off the bench. And that's pretty surprising for a player who, you know, just a couple of years ago was one of the best midfielders in Major League Soccer. Was one of the best players in general in Major League Soccer. It looks like his Portland Timbers career is over, honestly, and that's difficult. But I think someone in Major League Soccer could be getting a very good player in short order.
He definitely has a place in Major League Soccer. He is, again, you look back at that 2013 season, and yeah, that was a time when I would have thought the Portland Timbers were MLS Cup candidates. They had a lot of good players. I would argue on that team they had three MVP candidates on that side. But yeah, I think it's just the string of injuries and the reemergence, I guess, of Darlington Nagbe and Diego Valeri, as we know, since 2013 has been spectacular. It's weird. I think, yeah, like I said, I think he's got a place in Major League Soccer. Somebody is going to take him. He is a reliable piece. We saw that at Real Salt Lake. We saw that even more so in his earlier stretch in Portland. But yeah, I think, again, like the end of his RSL days, I think change will be good for Will Johnson. Will he ever be the player that he was in 2013 where he came out of nowhere with Portland? No, I don't think he will be. But he's still 28 years old. He's still got a wealth of MLS experience. He will be a very valuable piece for somebody.
Yeah, and I've heard Europe as well as a potential option for Will Johnson. I'm not sure exactly where he would fit in Europe. I mean, I don't necessarily see him as a top division player, just because I don't know if technically he has the, I guess, the flash almost. He's a very good player. He's got a lot of skill and a lot of physicality. He could be good in like an English championship, but I don't know if he has Premier League quality at all.
It's also tough. Like I said, he's only 28, but at the same time, you go overseas and, oh, you're already 28. It's difficult, and that takes a whole lot of his appeal off the table, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's true. I honestly think that he could find a good home in Major League Soccer, maybe, you know, hopefully with one of the Canadian teams, because I definitely like to see him on a Vancouver or even a Toronto FC. I know he isn't necessarily the best fit there in terms of what they have already, but you know, him and Michael Bradley are bros, so that could be that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. I mean, I definitely would be
The thing is with that one, if you were to put Johnson and Bradley together, the thing is you want both of them to push forward, but somebody has got to make the sacrifice, and you wonder who that is. I think it would probably be Johnson that would make that sacrifice because he's been injured, because Bradley is the captain, the leader of this team. I think Johnson would be the one making that sacrifice and having to play a little bit farther back. And then you wonder, is he the best suited for that role? I think that in his time in Major League Soccer, even going back to RSL, he would be more of an offensive player. So you wonder about that transition.
Well, that's pretty hypothetical anyway.
Yeah.
I think you just take a nail and just put one end of the field and one end to Will Johnson's boot and have like a string running between them so he can only go in like a certain area. It's like the whole like string when you're a kid idea.
Yeah.
So you can't go past too far upfield or else you get like pulled back. That'd be pretty hilarious. I think you know, there's all these innovations being made right now, Opta and other things. I think that would definitely, you know, if you want a player to be goal line technology, not important. If you want a player to be in good positioning, you go for the old nail and string technology.
Imagine if they got tied together. Oh man, that'd be brutal. That'd be like not having shoelaces tied, but just even worse.
Yeah, but you could keep like the straightest back line ever. The offside traps you could set with that thing. It'd be so easy for the referees as well, because you'd have this straight line of string just going the whole way, and they could easily just flag.
It's too bad somebody like Blas Perez is leaving the league, though, because you can imagine him just like going to all the little stakes and unscrewing them from the ground and just screwing around with everybody.
Would it be like a handball, though, if you like strung down the ball? Like if two of you like, or if you like clotheslined a player? Oh boy, this is too big of a rabbit hole for us to get into. Let's try and regroup here and get back into Canadian soccer, which is no less a rabbit hole maybe than one of the string soccer. Hey, look, I've watched enough of them to to be that savage about this. At any rate, it was actually pretty positive, their start to World Cup qualifying. I mean, they beat Honduras, which, you know, that alone is a huge accomplishment for the Canadian team, considering where they've come from. And, you know, watching that, you had to feel at least a little bit of confidence as to where this program's going, because, they didn't necessarily dominate Honduras, but they were the better team, I think, in that game. And obviously they got the results, which is what you want at the end of the day. And then going down to El Salvador and getting a draw isn't the end of the world. It's not great, though, either, because it probably means that they need another point in Central America, which is never easy.
I would agree with you. I think, yeah, the Honduras result is great. From what I saw from the bit of the Honduras match that I ended up watching, Honduras was putting the pressure on. But, again, Canada held strong. And yeah, Honduras wasn't able to break through. And there were some good chances that Canada generated from a little bit of run of play. Like, it wasn't very much. Canada is not a very good offensive team, as we know, but there were a few good moments off the counterattack. And again, it's like seeing flashes. It's very much a Vancouver Whitecaps model. Great defensively, you're seeing flashes out offensively, so it's just taking that next step that'll be interesting. I think that the El Salvador match, I think it's unfortunate. I think that even getting goals would have been something, some sort of sign of positivity. But yeah, you look at the remaining fixtures, I think that doubleheader against Mexico is going to be hellish. And like you were saying even before, I think that they've got to get a point out of Central America. Is Mexico the place to get that point? Definitely not in Mexico. That's not, we know almost for a fact that is not happening. In Canada, even that is going to be really tough. So then you look at the other matches and you really hope that Honduras and El Salvador, they just beat each other with baseball bats and leave us to pick up the scraps. It's unfortunate that it sort of has to come to that, and I think that Canada has done well so far, but you gotta hope. It's weird that you're thinking that early and hoping for other results to go your way, but I guess in a way it's never too early either.
That's a pretty Canadian mentality, is always hoping for the other results to go your way, because you can't take care of your own business necessarily. It's also funny that you said beating each other with bats, because that could literally happen. I mean, this is CONCACAF.
I mean,
these two teams went to war before over, well, not necessarily straight over a soccer game. That's kind of an exaggerated point, but I mean, it is called
the transition war. From laser pointers to baseball bats really isn't that big of a jump.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, you know, getting a point in Central America is difficult on its own. They haven't gotten a win in Central America since 2004, and that's pretty crazy. And I think, you know, if you're crazy enough to think they're getting a win at Azteca, if they haven't gotten a win in Central America since 2004,
no,
that's just not happening. Maybe in Honduras, but yeah, again, that's going to be pretty difficult. Now, Mexico in March should be very interesting, because the way I see it, a point is massive. Sorry. If they can get anything from that, I think that they get through, honestly. If they can get anything from that, then it makes everything just so much easier. Because I do see Honduras and El Salvador, they won't draw both games, because that would just be too nice for Canada. And Canada can never have it the easiest way possible. Mm-hmm. But I do see them kind of clubbing each other. I don't see either one of them picking up 6 points against each other. I don't think either of them have shown enough at this stage so far. I mean, Honduras hasn't scored yet. And El Salvador hasn't either, actually.
No.
So neither of these teams have scored yet. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a pretty big ask to ask either of them to pick up 6 points. So then you look at Canada and a crucial point against Mexico, who pretty much are going to get all points here. If Canada can't take a point off them, or if Honduras maybe can't take a point off them. So the way I see it is just that if you get a point in March, and it's not unfathomable. Unfathomable. Wow, I'm falling asleep as this podcast gets later. But you look at a result even like the 1-0 result earlier in the year against Colombia, where Canada just held so strong the entire match at the back line. And they do have a good goalkeeper, Milan Borjan, who can keep stuff out. And sadly, that's the way I kind of see this playing out. They'll get so late in the match against Mexico at home, and Mexico will score on them in like the 80th minute, because that's how it works. But I think that match does set precedent that this is a team that can probably defend a top team in the world. And, you know, it's just going to be luck of the draw as to whether they can, you know, just keep it 0-0.
I think you're fair. I think that even going back a few weeks ago, we were saying by general consensus, Mexico was going to run this table and get 18 points out of 18. We were saying El Salvador was going to do the opposite of run the table.
Yeah.
I guess get the floor mopped, if that's a good analogy. Probably not. But
no.
El Salvador getting 0 points out of 18, that was the general consensus that we had. If Canada can break that in any way, it bodes very, very well for them. I do agree with you there. Do I think it's going to happen? It's, again, it's not happening in Mexico, plain and simple.
No.
In Canada, yeah, it's going to be difficult, though, because Mexico, yeah, you can look at a team like Honduras. They can put pressure on you, but Mexico is that team that is a next step up. Are they an elite team in the world? I don't think they are anymore. I don't know if they ever really were. I think that they're getting a little bit better, though. I think that they had a bit of a downtime, and they've sort of swapped places with the U.S. The U.S. is in a down, and Mexico is starting to build up a little bit more. But Mexico is one of those teams that can be persistent, and they can just keep coming and coming and coming for 90 minutes, and they will have the energy. They've got a lot of youthful energy up front that will just keep on hammering away. And as soon as Canada breaks, Mexico will take advantage. So they got to be really careful.
We saw that in the Honduras match. When Mexico played Honduras, Mexico were held for most of that match, and then finally they broke through and scored two or three. I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but as a Canada fan, you're kind of nervous because if Honduras nicked 3 points or even 1 point off of Mexico, that's almost game over right there. But then Mexico obviously took care of business. So that's what it's going to be. That's what Canada's going to have to contend with. You know, as they get tired, can they continually hold Mexico? And at the same time, could they potentially catch them on the counterattack and, you know, maybe get, I mean, this is pretty crazy of an idea, but maybe get one of their own against Mexico. So that's what you'd be looking at. Let's switch gears now to the women's national team, which we haven't necessarily talked a ton about, but they will be competing in the new year in the women's Olympic qualifiers for this summer in Rio. Pretty easy group for Canada, actually. Guatemala, Guyana, and Trinidad and Tobago. Honestly, I'd see Canada's men's national team topping that group, which usually means that it's pretty easy streets for the women's national team. The one concern I would have, though, is, you know, obviously you top that group, or, you know, most probably you top that group, but from there, you have a one-game semifinal playoff that you have to win against Mexico or, God forbid, the United States, who have lost to Mexico in the past at this level. So then you have to win that match, and you don't have much of a warm-up going into it.
Yeah, I think that, like you said, I think you hit the nail on the head there. Mexico is definitely possible. They have, a good women's program, but I think that Canada, when they're firing, they're better. I think that Mexico is definitely the favorite of that for obvious reasons. The United States women's national team, they are the reigning world champions now.
Yeah.
And they just seem, everyone talks about Abby Wambach, Sydney LaRue, Alex Morgan. But then, even to me, all of a sudden, Carly Lloyd came out of nowhere and is now like becoming the face of this offensive team. And again, the United States are just so incredibly deep in the women's game. And I don't really know what their weakness is, and that's a really scary proposition for Canada to go up against.
I think it comes down to the friendlies that Canada play before this competition, and just the fact that, and they will be, we'll talk about that in just a minute, they are playing a number of friendlies, but just getting themselves ready, because I don't think the Guatemala, Guyana, or Trinidad and Tobago games are going to get them ready for a match against Mexico, who on their day, Canada is not much better than anymore, but at least better than.
They have the advantage.
Yes, they do have the advantage, but, you know, those games won't prepare them for it. So I think that's what they do in terms of their preparation prior to this. I think there's a very good chance Canada gets to Rio. And, you know, if I had to lay money on it, I would obviously do so. But, you know, it's not, you know, when you look at an easy group for them, it's not all it's cracked up to be. It's going to be difficult for them. Now, more pressing is the fact that the Canada U20 women's team are going to kick off qualifiers tomorrow for their World Cup, which will take place next November, October time. So in a year's time, their group is pretty similar in terms of quality. It's Honduras, Trinidad and Tobago, and Jamaica, all of which aren't known for the women's program. Now, the interesting thing here, for me at least, is the fact that you know, their roster isn't necessarily what it could be. I mean, you've got some good players there. You've got Sorayeka, who's featured for the Canadian women's national team before. You've also got players like Victoria Pickett, Sarah Stratagakis, who I was very much impressed by at the Pan Am Games. A couple of others who have featured for Canada at higher levels before. But at the same time, John Herdman's decided to take a lot of the good young players and bring them to his camp for the senior women's national team, where they play against Mexico on December 9th. Interesting game, actually, considering Mexico could be the crux of their CONCACAF qualifier, or of their Olympic qualifiers, rather. And then they also take on Brazil and Croatia as well in that time, in this upcoming month. But on that team are players, you know, the players you would see omitted from that group. Players like Gabrielle Carl, Marie Lavasseur, Summer Clark, and you know, obviously the player who everyone's looking for, which is Jessie Fleming, depending upon what happens with, you know, her club matches there. But, you know, seeing these players all miss out on, you know, the U20 camp is kind of weird. Why wouldn't you have your best team there if you want to do well at the women's or at the U20 World Cup next year?
In a way, it's a battle on two fronts, though. It's tough. And I don't know, which tournament do you prioritize? Do you prioritize the U20 or do you prioritize the Olympics? I would favor towards the Olympics. But yeah, it's difficult, and it's just, I don't know, I really don't follow the U20 women's team. That's your thing. Mr. Mitch Tierney watching every single... I'm pretty sure on a Saturday afternoon one time, Mitch would just go out and watch like a Canadian U8 men's national team game. I would not put it past him. But no, in all seriousness, though, I think it's a depth issue, and you want to have your best resources available for the highest levels. And it's unfortunate that Canada doesn't have the depth to really cover that yet. But it's just a building process, unfortunately, if we're going to the cliche.
Yeah, I made a mistake there. Actually, Jessie Fleming was not called up for either national team. But I'd agree, like, it's tough because you have to prioritize one competition, and the main competition here is the Olympic Games. But I don't necessarily see a spot for a lot of these younger players on the Olympic team. I'd be stunned if, you know, someone like Marie Lavasseur or Gabrielle Carl made the Olympic team. So yeah, that's something to look out for, is just the fact that, you know, this under-20 Canadian women's team isn't full strength. But at the same time, I do see them making it through. I mean, if they have a similar situation to the Canadian women's national team, where they have a fairly easy group, and then you know, they'll have to play that semifinal round against a difficult team coming in, I guess, soft, sort of. But at the same time, they do have a third place game that they can fall back on if they lose that one. So yeah, I don't think there's three teams in CONCACAF who are better than them at this point. I think that they'll you know, even if they get by with that third place game, I think they will make it to the World Cup.
I think that would work for them, though. I think that if they were to get against the United States or Mexico, one of them warms them up better for the other. Because again, yeah, it's, a lot of it is just the preparedness, and it's having that strength of competition. I think getting that experience against good teams, yes, it's going to hurt, but I think in the long run, it'll strengthen them. It'll build that character and that depth and that confidence, even that, yeah, we can go up against these guys on a regular basis, because we know that Canada's women's team is good.
Yeah.
But they, again, like every Canadian national team, it seems they have flashes, and we need to see that on a more consistent level. And you're not going to see that. You'll see that by beating the lower teams, but how much does it really mean?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. It should be very interesting, because I really do think that this is a good group, especially at full strength. I don't know too much about, you know, this full group that they've called up for the U20 qualifiers, because it is semi second choice. But watching a lot of these players at the Pan Am Games, there's some obvious quality in the Canadian system, and It's exciting to see. It's going to take them a couple of years to get integrated, because the way I see it is I guess under 23, like that group, there's not that many players. I mean, there's Buchanan and Ashley Lawrence, and now Summer Clark as well has committed to the Canadian program, which is pretty exciting. But there's not that many players at that age group which are ready to step in and replace Christine Sinclair or Sophie Schmidt. Well, I guess Schmidt's a bit younger, but like a Diana Matheson would be a better example. So, you know, having this young, I guess like 17 to 18-year-olds rather, who are very good is the next step, and that's what hopefully will carry Canada forward at some point in the future. Let's wrap up the discussion here for this week. You can follow us on Twitter at The Real Nort.
Don't follow the fake Nort.
No, it's not a Twitter account yet. I've checked.
I don't think so. Yeah.
But we'll make it at some point, I'm sure.
At some point.
you can follow me at Mitchell Tierney. You can look out for us on lastwordonsports.com for Norton stuff and wakingthered.com. Or also you can see us walking real tired in the downtown Toronto area. We both are in exam season right now, so not necessarily in the best health or mind state overall.
Not really, no. I'm definitely feeling it.
Yeah, as you've heard probably during this podcast, we stumbled a couple words and otherwise.
We're a little bit rusty. We'll get back to our usual top drawer Canadian soccer podcasting eventually.
Maybe. We'll see. And finally, you can subscribe to us on iTunes if you feel so inclined. You can search after the anthems, or the link should be provided on both Waking the Red and Last Word on Sports, provided Norton figures out how to do that.
Yep.
We'll have this conversation after the show, but have a great week, everyone.
Take care.